Geekscape.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today's narration will be the fifth one from Geoffrey of Monmouth's The History of the Kings of Britain. And we're going to move forward slightly in the book. After King Belinus, we had Gurgwit Barbtruck. After Gurgwit Barbtruck, we had King Gwythelyn and his wife Marcia. After that, we had Archgallo. After Archgallo, we had Eliduras. After Eliduras, we had a son of Gormanianus who accepted the crown. Eventually, we had Heli, the son of Digueillus, who succeeded him and ruled the kingdom for 40 years. And Heli had three sons, Lud, Cassivellaunus, and Nennius. Lud, the eldest of these, accepted the kingship after his father's death. He was famous for his town planning activities. He rebuilt the walls of the town of Trinivantium and girded it around with innumerable towers. He ordered the citizens to construct their homes and buildings there in such a style that no other city in the most far-flung of kingdoms could boast of palaces more fair. Lud was a warrior king, lavish in arranging feasts. However many other cities he might possess, this one he loved above all, and in it he passed the greater part of each year. As a result, it was afterwards called Car Lud, and then, as the name became corrupted, Car Lundane. In a later age, as languages evolved, it took the name London. And later still, when the foreign invaders landed and conquered the country, it was called Lundrays. When Lud died, his body was buried in the aforementioned city, near to the gateway, which in the British tongue is still called Port Lud, after him, although in Saxon it bears the name Ludgate. Two sons were born to Lud, Androgeus and Tenvantius. In view of their youth, they were in no position to govern the kingdom, and Lud's brother, Cassivellaunus, was preferred in their stead. As soon as he was crowned king, he gained such high esteem for his bounty and his prowess that his fame was spread abroad through far distant kingdoms. As a result, the kingship of the entire realm came into his hands, instead of into those of his nephews. However, Cassivellaunus had such a sense of family solidarity that he did not wish the young men to be cut off from the kingship, and he allotted a large share of his realm to the two of them. He granted the town of Trinovantium and the Duchy of Kent to Androgeus, and to Tenvantius he gave the Duchy of Cornwall. Cassivellaunus himself remained in authority over both of them, and over the princes of the entire island, for he was the overlord by virtue of his crown. And now we get to the coming of the Romans. Meanwhile, it happened, as can be read in the histories of Rome, that after he had conquered Gaul, Julius Caesar came to the seacoast of the Ruteni. From there, he gazed across at the island of Britain and inquired of those standing about him what land it was and what folk inhabited it. When he had been told the name of the kingdom and of the inhabitants, he went on gazing out to sea. "By Hercules," he exclaimed, "those Britons come from the same race as we do, for we Romans too are descended from Trojan stock. After the destruction of Troy, Aeneas was our first ancestor, just as theirs was Brutus, that same Brutus whose father was Silvius, the son of Ascanius, himself the son of Aeneas. All the same, unless I am mistaken, they have become very degenerate when compared with us, and they can know nothing at all about modern warfare, living as they do, beyond the deep sea, and quite cut off from the world. It will be a simple matter to force them to pay tribute, and to swear perpetual obedience to the majesty of Rome. First of all, I must send a message to them, to order them to pay tax, just as other peoples do homage to the Senate, without their having been approached or attacked by the people of Rome, for we must not shed the blood of our kinsmen, nor offend the ancient dignity of our common ancestor, Priam. Caesar dispatched this message in a letter addressed to King Cassivellaunus. The latter was most indignant, and sent back an answer worded as follows. Cassivellaunus, the king of the Britons, sends his greetings to Gaius Julius Caesar. The cupidity of the Roman people, my dear Caesar, is really quite beyond belief. They have an insatiable thirst for anything made of gold or silver, to the point that they cannot leave even us alone, although we live over the edge of the world and far beyond the perilous seas. They even have the nerve to stretch out their greedy fingers towards our small revenues, which up to now we have enjoyed in peace. This does not satisfy them. They want us to surrender our liberty and to endure perpetual bondage by becoming subject to them. What you have sought from us, Caesar, is an insult to yourself, for a common inheritance of noble blood comes down from Aeneas to Britain and to Roman alike, and our two races should be joined in close amity by this link of glorious kinship. It is friendship which you should have asked of us, not slavery. For our part, we are more used to making allies than to enduring the yoke of bondage. We have become so accustomed to the concept of liberty that we are completely ignorant of what is meant by submitting to slavery. If the gods themselves try to take our freedom from us, we shall still do our utmost to resist them with all our strength in our effort to preserve that freedom. If you start attacking the island of Britain, as you have threatened, you must clearly understand, Caesar, that we shall fight for our liberty and for our kingdom. The moment he had read this letter, Gaius Julius Caesar prepared his fleet. He had to wait for a following wind before he could put into effect the threats which he had sent to Cassivellaunus. When the wind came which he wanted, Caesar immediately hoisted his sails and landed with his army in the estuary of the River Thames. As soon as the Romans had come ashore in their boats, Cassivellaunus marched to meet them with the whole of his force. He reached the town of Dorabellum, and there he took counsel with the princes of his kingdom as to how he could best drive the enemy back. With him was Belinus, the commander-in-chief of his army, with the help of whose planning and advice the whole kingdom was governed. Androgius, Duke of Trinovantium, and Tenventius, Duke of Cornwall, the two nephews of Cassivellaunus, were also there, and so too were three kings holding sway under Cassivellaunus, Cridus of Albany, Gwythiet of Venedotia, and Britahel of Domitia. These men had brought their troops with them, ready for the fray. Their advice was that Caesar's camp should be attacked immediately, and that they should charge at him and drive him away before he could occupy any city or fortress. If he once managed to invest some fortified place in the land, then in their opinion, the task of expelling him would be all the more difficult, for he would know where to find refuge for his troops. Everyone agreed with this, and they all marched forward to the seashore, where Julius Caesar had set up his camp and his tents. The two armies were drawn up in battle array, and the Britons engaged the enemy in hand-to-hand combat, matching javelin with javelin and sword thrust with sword thrust. On both sides, the wounded fell in heaps, with the weapons of war sticking in their entrails. The earth was drenched with the blood of the dying, as when a sudden southwest wind drives back the ebbing tide. At the spot where the lines of battle were most closely interlocked, it chanced that Nennius and Androgius, with the men of Kent and the citizens of the town of Trinovantium, who were under their command, fell upon the battalion which was guarding the emperor's person. As the two sides made contact, the emperor's company came very near to being scattered by the close ranks of the invading Britons. They all fought together in a confused melee, and Nennius had the extraordinary luck of meeting Julius in person. As he rushed at Caesar, Nennius rejoiced in his heart at the fact that he would be able to deal at least one blow at so great a man. Caesar saw Nennius charging at him. He warded his opponent off with his shield and struck him on his helmet with his naked sword. Caesar lifted his sword a second time with the intention of following up his first blow and dealing a fatal wound. Nennius saw what he was at and held out his own shield. Caesar's sword glanced off Nennius' helmet and cut into his shield so deeply that when they had to abandon their hand-to-hand fight because of the troops who crowded in on them, the emperor could not wrench his sword out. Having acquired Caesar's sword in this way, Nennius threw away his own, dragged the other weapon out, and hurried off to attack the enemy with it. Everyone whom Nennius struck with this sword either had his head cut off or else was so seriously wounded as Nennius passed that he had no hope of recovery. As Nennius raged up and down in this way, the tribune Labienus came to meet him, but Nennius killed him on the spot. So passed the greater part of the day. The Britons pressed forward with their ranks undivided. As they charged boldly on, God favoured them, and victory was theirs. Caesar withdrew to a line between his camp and the ships, for his Romans were being cut to pieces. That night he reformed his ranks and went on board his ships, glad enough to make the sea his refuge. His comrades dissuaded him from continuing the fight, and he was happy to accept their advice and to return to Gaul. Cassivellaunus was delighted with his victory. He first gave thanks to God, then he summoned to him those who had shared his victory, and rewarded each man with princely gifts, according to the prowess he had shown. He was, however, stricken with grief, for his brother Nennius had been severely wounded and was lying with little hope of recovery. Julius had struck him in the battle, as we described, and his wound could not be treated by the doctor. Some 15 days after the battle, he died suddenly. When he had closed his eyes, they buried him in the town of Trinovantium by the north gate. At his funeral, they placed beside him in his coffin the sword of Caesar, which he had carried off in his shield during the fight. The sword was called Yellow Death, for no man who was struck by it escaped alive. When they saw Julius Caesar turn his back to the enemy in this way, and retire in disorder to their own seacoast, the Gauls did their utmost to rebel and throw off the dominion he had over them. They were under the impression that he was now so reduced in power that they no longer needed to fear him. One single rumour was on all men's lips, that the whole sea was seething with the ships of Cassivellaunus, who was following Caesar in his flight. The bolder spirits among the Gauls reached the point where they were debating how they could drive Caesar out of their territory. Julius Caesar learned this. He had no wish to fight a war on two fronts against a people roused to fury. He preferred to open his treasure chests and to call upon certain of the chief nobles in an effort to pacify them by bribing them each in turn. To the plebs, he promised freedom. To those who had been disinherited, he promised their lost possessions, and he even went so far as to promise liberation to the slaves. He who had once raged like a lion, as he took from them their all, now went about bleating like a gentle lamb, as with muted voice he spoke of the pleasure it caused him to be able to give everything back to them again. This soft, caressing behaviour continued until all were won over again, and he had recovered his lost power. Meanwhile, no day passed without his going over in his mind his own flight and the victory won by the Britons. 2 years passed. Then Caesar prepared to cross the sea a second time, in order to avenge himself upon Cassivellaunus. As soon as the latter heard of this, he garrisoned his cities everywhere, and wherever their walls were ruined, he repaired them. In every seaport he stationed fully equipped soldiery. What is more, below the waterline, in the bed of the River Thames, up which Caesar would have to sail if he were to approach the town of Trinovantium, Cassivellaunus planted stakes as thick as a man's thigh, and shod with iron and lead, so that Caesar's ships would be gutted as they moved forward. Every man of military age in the island was conscripted, barracks were built for them on the water's edge, and then Cassivellaunus awaited the enemy's coming. Once he had prepared all that he needed, Julius Caesar embarked with so many troops that no one could count them, for he was eager to inflict a signal defeat upon a people who had beaten him. Had he been able to land with his fleet undamaged, no doubt he would have achieved his aim. But as he cruised up the Thames in the direction of the aforementioned city of Trinovantium, his ships ran upon the stakes which I have described, and so suffered their moment of sudden jeopardy. Thousands of soldiers were drowned as the river water flowed into the hold ships and sucked them down. When Caesar discovered what was happening, he made every effort to furl his sails and then ran ashore as fast as he could. Those survivors, who by the skin of their teeth had escaped from so great a peril, now clambered with Caesar onto dry land. Cassivellaunus observed all this from his vantage point on the river bank. That so many were dying as they sank in the water rejoiced his heart, but he was worried by the fact that the others were saving themselves. He signalled to his troops and charged down upon the Romans. Despite the danger which they had endured in the river, once they reached dry land, the Romans withstood the onslaught of the Britons bravely enough. Bolstered up by their own courage, they inflicted no small slaughter, but the carnage they themselves suffered was greater than the damage they did. They had been sorely tested in the river, and now they moved forward with their ranks thinned. The Britons, on the other hand, were reinforced as each hour passed by the moving up of additional troops, until they outnumbered the Romans by 3-1, and thus they were victorious over their weakened enemy. When Caesar saw that he was beaten, he fled to his ships with a few men left to him and gained the safety of the open sea without being hindered. He hoisted his sails to take the timely winds which arose and so reached the shore of the Moriani. There he took shelter in a certain tower which he had built in a place called Odnia before setting out this time to Britain. He could not trust the loyalty of the fickle Gauls, for they might well rise against him a second time, and as they are said to have done before, when it was first known that he had shown his back to the Britons. It was against this eventuality that he had constructed the tower as a refuge, so that he could resist an insurgent people, should they rise against him, as he had foreseen. Cassivellaunus was greatly elated when he had won this second victory. He issued an edict that all the British leaders should assemble with their wives in the town of Trinovantium to do honour to their country's gods who had given them victory over so mighty an emperor. They all gathered together without delay. Sacrifices of various kinds were made, and many cattle were killed. They offered 40,000 cows, 100,000 sheep, and so many fowl of every kind that it was impossible to count them. They also sacrificed 300,000 wild animals of various species which they had caught in the woods. When they had done honour to the gods, they feasted on the viands left over, as the custom was on sacrificial occasions. What remained of that day and night they spent in various sporting events. While these sports were going on, it happened that two well-known youths, one the king's own nephew, and the other, the nephew of Duke Androgeus, wrestled together man to man, and then disagreed as to who had gained the upper hand. The name of the king's nephew was Hiraldas, and the other man was called Culinus. First they wrangled with each other, then Culinus drew his sword and cut off the head of the king's nephew. The court was in a ferment over this death, and the news of it reached Cassivellaunus. He was greatly upset by the death of his relative, and he ordered Androgeus to bring Culinus before him in his court, stipulating that once Culinus had appeared, he should undergo such sentence as the leaders might pronounce, lest Hiraldas should go unavenged, always provided, of course, that he had been killed unjustly. Androgeus guessed what the king intended to do. He answered that he had a court of his own, and that any case brought against his men ought to be tried there. If Cassivellaunus was determined to have the law on Culinus, then by age-old custom he ought to seek justice in the town of Trinovantium. When Cassivellaunus realised that he could not have satisfaction for his case, He threatened Androgeus and swore that he would ravage his duchy with fire and sword unless he agreed to his claim. Androgeus lost his temper and refused to obey the order. Cassivelanus lost his temper too and rushed off to ravage the lands of Androgeus. Through his relatives and friends, Androgeus kept in daily contact with the king in an attempt to persuade him to end his fit of temper. But when he realized that nothing he could do would appease the rage of Cassivelanus, Androgeus turned instead to thinking how he could best resist the king. In the end, he despaired of finding any other solution and decided to seek the help of Caesar himself. He sent a letter to Caesar, couched in the following terms. Androgeus, Duke of Trinovantium, who once sought the death of Gaius Julius Caesar, now hopes that he is in the best of health. I am sorry that I opposed you at the time when you were fighting against my king. If I had refused to take part in that campaign, then you would have beaten Cassivelanus. Since his success in that battle, he has become so arrogant that he has now made up his mind to drive me into exile from my own land, me, with whose help he won his victory. That is how he thinks my efforts should be rewarded. I saved his inheritance for him, and now he is trying to disinherit me. Twice I have restored his kingdom to him, and now he wants to leave me destitute. It was I who re-established his hold over all his possessions, by fighting against you. I swear by all the gods in heaven that I have never deserved his anger, unless, indeed, it can be said that I did deserve it simply by refusing to hand over my nephew, whom he wants to condemn to an unjust death. Let me explain to you what I am accused of, so that in your wisdom you may understand it the more fully. It so happened that in our joy over the victory, we arranged some religious ceremonies in the name of the gods of our country. When we had completed the sacrifices which we felt we owed to the gods, our young men competed together in certain sports which they arranged between themselves. Among the competitors, our two nephews, the king's and my own, were encouraged by the example set them by the others to meet each other in a wrestling match. My nephew won. The other man lost his temper most unsportingly and ran to hit my nephew, who avoided the blow and seized his opponent by the fist in which he was gripping his sword, hoping to wrest it from him. The king's nephew fell on the point of his own sword and then collapsed, having received a fatal stab wound. When the king heard of this, he ordered me to hand my boy over so that he might be punished for manslaughter. This I refused to do. Cassivelanus then invaded my dukedom with his entire army at his back and began to harry it unmercifully. It is for this reason that I ask for your compassion and that I seek your help, so that through you I may be restored to my position of honour and that through me you may become master of Britain. You need not hesitate over anything that I have suggested, for there is no thought of treachery in my mind. Human beings are conditioned by the chance happenings of history. It follows that those who have been enemies sometimes become friends, and that those who have run away may yet achieve victory. Julius read this letter. He was advised by his staff that he could not go to Britain solely on the Duke's verbal invitation, but that hostages must be sent to him, so that, with these to rely on, he might make his landing with a greater feeling of security. Androgeus immediately sent his own son Shaver to Caesar, together with 30 young nobles who were his own close relatives. Caesar was reassured by this handing over of hostages and reassembled his troops. The wind blew strongly from the east, and he landed in Richborough. Meanwhile, Cassivelanus was beginning to besiege Trinovantium, and was already sacking the villas on the outskirts of the city. When he heard the arrival of Julius, he abandoned the siege and hurried to meet the emperor. As he marched into a valley near Durabernia, he saw there the Roman army busy pitching its camp and putting up its tents. It was Androgeus who had led them to this spot, for he wanted them to occupy the town of Trinovantium in secret. Immediately, the Romans saw that the Britons had come. They armed themselves at great speed without losing a moment, and then drew up their men in companies. The Britons, for their part, put on their arms and arranged themselves in companies too. Androgeus himself lay hid with 5,000 armed men in a certain forest glade which they had chosen, ready to run to Caesar's help and to make a sudden unexpected charge against Cassivellaunus and his companies. When the two sides came together in this way, they immediately started hurling death-dealing weapons at each other and exchanging equally mortal blows with their swords. The companies of men charged at each other, and much blood was shed. On both sides, the wounded fell to the ground, just as autumn leaves drop from the trees. As they assaulted each other, Androgeus emerged from his grove and made a rear attack upon Cassivellaunus' battle line, on which the whole contest depended. In a short time, this line of soldiers had to give ground, for on the one side it had been devastated by the attack of the Romans a little earlier on, and now, on the other side, it was being hard-pressed by fellow Britons. The forces of Cassivellaunus were scattered. He turned in flight and ran from the battlefield. Nearby, there stood a rocky hill with a thick hazel wood at the top. Now that he had been defeated on the level ground, Cassivellaunus fled to this hill, and his men went with him. Once he had occupied the hilltop, he defended himself manfully and slew such of the enemy as pursued him. Both the Romans and the troops of Androgeus had followed close behind Cassivellaunus' companies and had continued to mangle them as they fled. Up the hill they came, charging time and time again, but they could not reach the top. The rocks on the hillside and the very steepness of the ridge afforded such good cover to the Britons that by occasional sallies from the summit they could kill off a number of the enemy. Caesar besieged the hill throughout the whole of that night, for darkness was already coming on. He cut off all means of retreat. Since he could not conquer the king by force of arms, his plan was to reduce him by hunger. How remarkable the British race was at that time! Twice it had put to flight the man who had subjected to his will the entire world. Even now, when driven off the battlefield, the Britons went on resisting the man whom the whole world could not withstand. They were ready to die for their fatherland and for their liberty. This is why Lucan praised them when he wrote about Caesar, "Territa quaesitis ostendit terga Britannis." 2 days now passed without Cassivellaunus having anything to eat. He began to fear that hunger would beat him and that he would be captured by Caesar. Cassivellaunus therefore sent a message to Androgeus, asking the duke to make peace for him with Julius, for otherwise the majesty of the race into which he, Androgeus, had been born, would come to an end with the capture of its king. In the same message, Cassivellaunus made it clear that he had done nothing to justify Androgeus in seeking to destroy him, although, indeed, he had caused him some disquiet. When the envoys had delivered their message, Androgeus said, "The leader, who is as fierce as a lion in peacetime, but as gentle as a lamb in time of war, is not really worth much. By all the gods of heaven and earth, my lord and master, who used to order me about, now pleads with me. Is he really ready to make peace with Caesar and do him homage, he whom Caesar once begged for peace? He should have foreseen that the man with whose help he once drove so great an emperor out of his realm might one day bring that same emperor back again. I ought not to have been treated so unjustly, for I was in a position to offer my service not only to him, but to someone else, if I wanted to. The man who piles insults and injuries upon the comrades in arms by whose very help he has triumphed is nothing but a fool. Victory is not won by any particular commander, but rather by those who shed their blood for him in the fighting. All the same, if I can, I will make peace for him, for the injury he did me is sufficiently avenged by the fact that he has begged me for mercy. Immediately after this, Androgeus went to Julius, put his arms around that leader's knees, and said the following things to him. You have revenged yourself sufficiently on Cassivellaunus. Now, have mercy on him. What is there left for him to do but render homage to you and pay tribute to the majesty of Rome? Caesar did not answer, so Androgeus spoke again. All that I promised you, Caesar, was this, that I would help you to humble Cassivellaunus and to conquer Britain. Well, Cassivellaunus is beaten, and with my help, Britain is in your hands. What more do I owe you? The Creator of all things does not intend that I should permit my leader to be bound in fetters, now that he has asked mercy of me, and assured me of retribution for the injury which he has done me. I cannot allow you to kill Cassivellaunus while I myself remain alive. If you do not accept my advice, I shall not scruple to give him all the help I can. Julius' resolution was blunted by his fear of Androgeus. He made peace with Cassivellaunus, and the latter promised to pay a yearly tribute. The tax, which he pledged himself to pay, was 3,000 pounds of silver. Julius and Cassivellaunus then became friends and gave each other presents. Caesar wintered in Britain and crossed back over the sea to Gaul the following spring. Sometime later, he collected an army together from every source and every race of mankind, and then marched to Rome to attack Pompey. 6 years passed, and then Cassivellaunus died and was buried in York. Tenvantius, Duke of Cornwall, the brother of Androgeus, succeeded Cassivellaunus, for Androgeus himself had gone off to Rome with Caesar. Tenvantius was therefore crowned king, and he governed his realm diligently. He was a warlike man, and he insisted upon the full rigour of the law. After him, his son Cymbeline was raised to royal eminence, a powerful warrior whom Augustus Caesar had reared in his household and equipped with weapons. This king was so friendly with the Romans that he might well have kept back their tribute money, but he paid it of his own free will. In those days was born our Lord Jesus, by whose precious blood was redeemed the human race, which hitherto had been bound by the devil's chain.